So, welcome everybody. This is the 8th lecture in my course on Tranquility and Insight in Early Buddhist Discourse. Just 3 minutes ago, 4 minutes ago, I was thrown out, and this is why I'm now in at Bhikkhu Anālayo 2. I hope I'm not going to be thrown out again, at least for the next 1.5 hour. Otherwise, it'll be difficult. Yeah, so I start again with some of the questions from the forum. And thanks to all of you who have contributed to that. This is Michael Beiser. He had asked another question, which I answered directly on the forum. And he confirmed, you may remember last time when we were discussing the Aninja Sampaya Sutta and its parallel, this reference to Sangvattanika Vijnana, and whether there is a possible sectarian influence behind that. And there was this point that in the Theravada tradition, the idea that there could be something in between death and rebirth is not accepted. And so, just to clarify again, as Michael brought this up, the reference to the Sangvattanika Vijnana in the Anindasapaya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 106, is interesting in so far as it is the opposite of what we would expect if the passage is the result of sectarian influence. This Sangvattanika Vijnana, which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as the evolving consciousness, the use of this term gives us the feeling that there's some kind of process, it evolves from passing away to going somewhere else. So in terms of terminology, this is closer to the idea that there is something in between. In contrast, the Madhyama Agama version would fit very well with the idea that the moment one dies, that moment right away after one is reborn. So we get here the two discourse versions, which are actually, well, the Madhyama Agama is not opposite to the Sarvastivada version, but which are the opposite of what we would expect if the passage had been influenced by sectarian concerns. And moreover, it would also be difficult that the Sangvattanika Vijnana, this evolving consciousness, is also found in the Tibetan version. And the Tibetan stems from the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, a school whose precise relationship to the Sarvastivada is not entirely clear, but it's definitely very close. Then there are several questions by Jeff Hardin. He says, I have been having some difficulty with the translation of Aninja as imperturbable. The Pali-English dictionary has the definition as imperturbable character remaining static. I can't understand this in reference to the state of mind of an arahant, but as a descriptor for the fourth jhana and the immaterial states, to me it seems that they are perturbable, that is, they are impermanent. There are conditions for their arising and for their cessation. Such conditions for cessation could be considered as a perturbation. Yeah, I think we have to see that in the early discourses, the terminology is used not in a totally fixed and static manner. So the word aninja as imperturbable does not mean eternal. It does not mean that there may not be a change at some point, but it describes a condition of the mind that as long as it lasts, it cannot be perturbed. So when somebody is in the fourth jhana or in the immaterial attainments, this is considered a condition of the mind that cannot be perturbed. One will not hear if outside somebody is making noise or whatever is happening. One is imperturbable as long as that attainment lasts. In the case of an arahant then, an arahant, he or she is imperturbable as long as he or she is an arahant, which in early Buddhism is considered to be a permanent attainment, permanent in quotation marks. So once somebody has reached full awakening, the type of imperturbability of someone who is an arahant is continuous. There will be no end to that. And this usage of aninja to cover these two areas is perhaps we could compare it to another term that is used, that is a cetu vimutti, liberation of the mind. When the term cetu vimutti comes together with panya vimutti and the liberation by wisdom, and furthermore it's qualified as akuppa, the nothing beyond that, the supreme cetu vimutti, then it really means the condition of an arahant. But if cetu vimutti, liberation of the mind, occurs on its own, it can simply refer to experience of a jhana or to the practice of the Brahma viharas. So we see here that early Buddhism, as far as I can understand, there is a clear, almost an effort through the use of vocabulary to include the tranquility, the samatha experiences and attainments as something that is very worthwhile and important, and that can lead one to a condition of temporary, citta vimutti, temporary imperturbability. But always the hierarchy is that there is something that is complete, permanent, unchanging citta vimutti, unchanging imperturbability, and that is the development of full awakening. So here's another comment by Jeff Hardin. Your comments about the Pali versions of the discourses often giving harsher rebukes from the Buddha towards monks is interesting. In your comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya, you mentioned that both Majjhima Nikaya 22 and Majjhima Nikaya 38, which have two of the Buddha's harshest rebukes of monks found in the suttas, have identical passages and parallels. Is there a pattern in the different versions of rebukes that point to traits of the different transmission lineages? Yeah, I believe the case of Majjhima Nikaya 22 and Majjhima Nikaya 38 is different, because here we are dealing with misrepresentation of the teachings. In both cases, monks have been making the statement the Buddha says so and so, and even when told by other monks, look, this is not really the way, they have been insisting on that. And this is a very difficult situation if we keep in mind that we are here in an oral culture where there is no written records. So the only way for somebody who hasn't met the Buddha personally to know what the Buddha teaches is by hearsay. And those who are expected to be able to represent the Buddha appropriately would obviously be his disciples. So if a monk or a nun goes around and saying the Buddha teaches so and so, and this is really wrong, it's the opposite of what the Buddha actually teaches, and being taught by other monks or other nuns, look, this is not the way, and this person still insists, no, this is the way I understand what the Buddha teaches, then I think a rather harsh rebuke is understandable. But what I find in general, and I haven't really followed it up and made a study of it, is that there are several instances, I just noticed this, where the Theravada version shows some toughness or harshness of the Buddha, where this is not found in the parallels, and where it is not clear from the context that this is warranted. And one was the situation of the discourse we looked at, where it's not really clear. The monk comes to the Buddha and says, can I have a teaching? I want to practice intensively. Why should the Buddha pounce on him? I mean, he doesn't pounce on him, but why should the Buddha rebuke him for that? Perhaps there was a reason. I mean, I have no way of deciding which is the more original, and whether it was deleted in the Chinese Agama version or added in the Pali version, but I just noticed this. And in another case on the debater Satchika, I found arguments that make it clear that the Pali version has become stronger in its formulation. And I just find this an interesting thing to note, because sometimes arguments are built on this harshness of the Buddha, and that the Buddha called Devadatta like a piece of spittle, and that in the Sutta Nipata there's a discourse where the Buddha is offered a beautiful girl, and then he replies, "I wouldn't even want to touch her with my foot, this bag full of urine and excrement." I think it's good for us on reading to be aware that these, in fact, as everything we have in front of us, need not be records of what actually happened, and that specifically with this kind of more tough approach, one can't really come to a definite conclusion, but just to be aware of the fact, it's always when the parallel version does not have it, there's always the issue is somewhat in a gray area, and we have to see if from context or other arguments we can say, well, this looks more probable or this looks more probable. In the case of this Buddha rebuking this monk that we had last time, I don't see any particular point to argue in one direction or the other. Then there's a question by Robert Grosch. Regarding Madhyama Agama 75, excuse me, I'm not completely sure about the difference of experiencing the sphere of nothingness from experiencing nirvana. From the viewpoint of the five khandhas, nirvana is reached, for example, by witnessing the complete cessation of all five khandhas, that realizing that these are all impermanent and dukkha. This leads to abandoning the sense of a self. That's another part. According to Madhyama Agama 75, one has to realize that the self is empty in order to reach the sphere of nothingness. Is it then the case that this is not equivalent to nirvana because this abandoning of the self is still incomplete? After the sphere of nothingness, there comes still the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. Hence, in the sphere of nothingness, there is still something perceiving nothing. Thus, in this state, there is still a subtle trace of consciousness and perception still remaining. Yeah, that's a very, very complex question. First of all, realization that there is no self can take place at different levels. And there is some initial realization even before one becomes a stream entry. But it is only when one completely realizes it fully that full awakening is attained. And the intriguing thing in the present discourse is obviously that this core insight of the early Buddhist teachings is used in order to facilitate entry into a samatha attainment, into nothingness, which has some similarity with it, but it's obviously not exactly the same. And as Robert rightly points out, it's not a cessation experience, because nothingness is still there. And after that, there's further refinement. One goes up to neither perception nor non-perception. So there clearly, it's not a cessation experience itself. Consciousness, perception, aggregates are still there. But it goes very close. And this is why it would also be understandable that when the Buddha, according to Arya Pariyasana Sutta, he made this discovery, he became awakened. But the first person, according to the traditional account, he was in thinking of sharing this discovery with were teachers who had themselves attained nothingness, or in the case of Uddhaka Ramaputta, it seems that only his father had attained neither perception nor non-perception. But both people who were really practicing in this direction. And so it shows us that there is a considerable similarity. Similarity is perhaps the wrong word. Affinity or resonance is perhaps better. There's some closeness between these conceptions, but they are clearly not identical. And somebody can realize nirvana without ever experiencing the sphere of nothingness. And somebody as the teacher of the Bodhisattva, Alara Kalama, can have the attainment of nothingness, which I think is the full attainment described there in the discourse, without necessarily having experienced nirvana, without being still a so-called putujana, a worldling. Yeah, now we move on to Madhyama Agama 76. There is still a question by Jeff Hardin. Pandit, you mentioned that in your research for this course, you uncovered another parallel from Madhyama Agama 76. Given the abundant use of pericopes in the Sutta Pitaka, could you please describe what constitutes considering two texts to be parallels rather than just having similar passages? Yeah, this is a very tricky issue. There is some degree of subjectivity involved when one comes to a gray area. We have been discussing that also among those in the team of Sutta Central. And I wrote a little paper also where I'm trying to see what enables us to say these discourses are parallels. And sometimes there's some kind of in-between, and we have opted for the terminology of speaking of partial parallels, which is, for example, when you have one discourse that is very long and you have another one that has only one chunk out of it. Let me talk of partial parallels. Usually, the pericopes themselves cannot be really used because then certain descriptions are occurring so often all over the Sutta Pitaka that we would have to call all these parallels. And the introduction narrations often differ. This is something that was already pointed out by a scholar called Gregory Chopin. There's even an instruction in some Vinayas, Mula Savastivada and Mahasangika, to recite amongs that if you have forgotten where a certain discourse took place, just say it was at such and such a place, Savati and a few other places are given. There's a clear lack of concern for a so-called historical information among early Buddhist reciter circles. So location is not a good identifier for parallels. And sometimes, as I think we will see soon in Madhyama Agama 78 or 79, which I hope we will be covering today, even proper names get mixed up. What usually makes for a parallel is if a topic is similar. Like in the discourse we discussed last time, Madhyama Agama 76, there was this a monk, unnamed moreover, who asks for instruction, and he gets this combination of samatha and vipassana, where he gets like the satipatthana instructions, and then the concentration that has come out of that in with savitaka, with the initial and sustained mental application, then without initial but with sustained, without both, and then with piti, etc. This is a passage that doesn't occur very often. And this whole setting occurs in the Madhyama Agama version and in the Samyutta Nikaya to some part and in the Anguttara to another part. So based on this, I think these can be considered as proper parallels. And it is basically just following up such similarities that Shitsen Akanuma, whom I showed to you last time, has been identifying parallels. And those of you who have been with me through the last years, sometimes you remember we come across discourses, they are so close. Nobody would have any question that they come from the same, that these are parallels of the same versions. But at other times we have discourses that show considerable differences. And hopefully still today we will come to a discourse that has no parallel in the Pali canon. We have had that also before. And there again, it is not easy to say, well, it has no parallel in the Pali canon, so it must be late. Actually, this is not the case. Some of these are late, but not all of them. It simply all reflects this basic situation of oral transmission, where there are different transmission lineages, and some texts can get lost, and some texts become, because of the working mechanics of memory, become restructured, or one long text, a small piece goes off and becomes a text on its own, or elsewhere two pieces that seem to belong together are joined to become a single discourse. We can see all these patterns there, and sometimes it is not entirely clear if we can really speak of a parallel, but I think in this case it is possible to say that Madhyama Agama 76 has two Pali parallels. This is from Linda Grace. regarding the Anguttara Parallel 8.63. Actually, after metta is described in this way, the text is abbreviated for the other three Brahma Viharas, and I assume the abbreviation is meant to include the description of the two preceding paragraphs. Yes, I think that's the case. However, I am a little unclear regarding the order in the text, as then the next paragraph once again goes to the jhana levels before outlining Satipatthana. She gives the page references to Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, page 1205. Also, according to footnote 1765 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, the commentator seems to have a different idea as to what is meant, implying that it is not metta that should be developed to jhana level, but rather different objects. Am I reading this correctly? Yeah, there's 2 points that come to my mind in relation to this question. One is that we often find the Brahma Viharas mentioned side by side with the jhanas in the discourses. And this at first sight is obviously puzzling, because the Brahma Viharas can be developed up to jhana level, so once the jhanas are mentioned, why the Brahma Viharas put side by side with them? And my personal understanding is that this has to do with the Brahma Viharas being a somewhat specific type of practice, in that the condition of Cheto Vimutti, which I was mentioning just before, in the case of the Brahma Viharas, because of the nature of this practice, already can happen before the actual level of jhana is attained. So, say somebody is practicing mindfulness of breathing, then the condition of the citta vimutti, that the mind is really liberated from all confines, requires entry into the first jhana, and usually the breath as an object, according to the traditional explanation, then will be replaced by a nimitta. We discussed that before. But with the Brahma Viharas, it seems that when one is able to engender this condition of boundless radiation of metta, karuna, etc. in all direction, even before having reached jhana level, then this is already a condition that can be reckoned a liberation of the mind, because by the boundlessness of the practice, it is liberated from confines, and by the nature of the practice, metta is by nature, if it is properly practiced, free from anger and aversion, so it has these aspects of liberation. And we even also get this statement that the Brahma Viharas have an effect on karma, that they can influence the fact that somebody practices the Brahma Viharas and he or she passes away, then this Brahma Vihara practice will have a very strong impact on the conditions that lead to the future rebirth. And they have it said, yang pamana katang kamang nan tatra vasisati, other karma that has a more restrictive effect or a limiting effect will not be able to overrule the karma of the Brahma Vihara practice. Again, we do not get this statement for any other jhana practice, even for the immaterial spheres. So my personal understanding is that the Brahma Viharas are somewhat special, and this is why they are mentioned extra. They are seen as of such importance that even when the jhanas are already mentioned, they are mentioned alongside to just make this point. But this is just my personal hypothesis. I have no commentarial explanation or discourse that backs up my interpretation in this case. It's just my understanding. And the second question, the discourse we discussed last time, it keeps on, like, it describes one practice and then it says, imang samadhin, this concentration, develop it in this and this way. And my understanding of this instruction would be that this is not meant to mean exactly this particular type of meditation practice, now you cultivate it in this way, but more it's just talking about samadhi in general. In the sense that I think we already discussed earlier, that a samadhi itself can refer to tranquility and to insight. So you can call Satipatthana a samadhi practice, you can call the jhanas a samadhi practice, you can call the Brahma Viharas a samadhi practice. So whichever of these practices you do, the level of concentration, of samadhi, of collectedness of the mind you have reached you use that to cultivate something else, but that is still Imam Samaring. It's your concentration. And this is maybe also the reply to a question raised by Robert Crush. He says, in the sutta, the development of each of the four foundations of mindfulness seem to be followed by a passage that describes that these should be used to establish concentration up to the fourth jhana. If I'm not mistaken, in modern meditation techniques, only either the body or the feeling contemplations are used to establish concentration up to jhana level, if at all. To be more precise, concentration arises as a consequence of such contemplations. I wonder if it is possible to develop the contemplation of mental formations and or the contemplation of dhammas up to jhana level. Yeah, I like the specification, the concentration arises as a consequence of such contemplations. I think in principle there would be no problem if one takes this approach that I suggested about Imam Samadhi. So whatever level of concentration one has been able to cultivate with Satipatthana practice, which I would understand to be a practice that foregrounds mindfulness as an open receptive awareness of phenomena as they present themselves in their changing and conditioned nature. But this obviously also involves some degree of stability of the mind, and this stability of the mind then is a foundation for a shift in practice where this more open, broad approach that sees variety is somewhat changed to a shift towards a more focused type of practice, where one stays with one object and the mind becomes more concentrated. Mindfulness is still there, but concentration is being foregrounded now. And once the mind becomes unified with that object, then one gets into absorption. One can experience jhana attainment. So this, in principle, could be done with any of the four satipatthanas. And I think in the contemplation of dhammas, especially the cultivation of the bhujangas, really points, gives important pointers for those qualities not only required for awakening, which is the actual purpose of the awakening factors, but also rather helpful for the cultivation of deeper states of concentration, particularly the series leading from joy via tranquility to actual concentration. Yeah, this was about what I had from the forum. And today I wanted to go a little bit forward with our discourses, because there's the Kayagatasati Sutta, which I think is 81, Madhyama Agama 81, and I would really like to have time to go through that, because that is of considerable importance. It's probably the key discourse for our overall theme in the set of discourses we have here in the Madhyama Agama. So the discourses that come now are not so directly relevant to our topic, so I thought of moving through them and seeing that we move a little bit forward. But obviously, if there's any questions or unclarity, please, during the course here, you type in and ask or put it in the forum. And so last time I didn't finish the very last part of Madhyama Agama 77. The Blessed One asked, Anuruddha, for what reason does the Tathagata declare of disciples who have died that so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place and so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place? Excuse me. Anuruddha, the Tathagata does not say this in order to amuse people. It is not in order to deceive people. Excuse me. Or out of a wish to make people happy that it declares of people, disciples who have died, that so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place, so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place. Anuruddha, the Tathagata does it just so that pure and faithful clansmen and clanswomen We have great faith, great devotion, may develop great delight. And so that on hearing this true Dharma and discipline, they might wish to follow those examples thus and thus. It is for this reason that the Tathagata declares of disciples who have died that so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place, and so-and-so has been reborn in such and such a place. And after this basic explanation that the Buddha makes statement that, say, this disciple of mine has passed away as a once returned and been reborn there and there, he gives then examples. The whole point is about raising inspiration. A monk may hear that the venerable so-and-so has died at such and such a place, and that the Buddha has declared that the deceased had attained final knowledge. Knowing as it really is, birth is ended, the holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. Either he may have himself seen that venerable one, or he may have frequently heard others say that venerable one had faced thus, adhered to the precepts thus, had much learning thus, practiced kindness and generosity thus, had wisdom thus. Having heard that, this person recollects the faith of that venerable one, his adherence to the precepts, his much learning, his kindness and generosity, his wisdom. Having heard this true Dharma discipline, that monk may aspire to follow this example thus and thus. Anuruddha, in this way, he will certainly attain some level of distinction and peacefully abide in it. So the whole point is to make the teachings tangible by giving an actual example. If we know someone who has attained, become a noble one, has realized Nibbana, then the whole idea of the practice becomes so much more tangible and vivid. And one can also see, look, this person has such and such a quality, and one can see where oneself is and aspire to cultivate these qualities. So the discourse continues to make the same statements for a monk who has attained non-return, once return and stream entry. Then it works through the same pattern for bhikkhunis, a bhikkhuni who has attained full awakening, non-return, once return, stream entry. And then it makes the same pattern again for lay people. And in the case of lay people, full awakening is not mentioned. Only non-return, once return and stream entry. And here is the last case. Again, Anuruddha, a female lay disciple may hear that the female lay disciple so-and-so has died at such and such a place, and that the Buddha has declared that she had eradicated three fetters and attained stream entry. That without falling into evil states, she will certainly proceed towards bright awakening. After experiencing at most seven existences, being reborn seven times among gods and human beings, she will attain the ending of dukkha. Either she may have herself seen that female lay disciples, or she may have frequently heard others say, that female lay disciple had faith thus, adhered to the precepts thus, had much learning thus, practiced kindness and generosity thus, had wisdom thus. Having heard that, this person recollects the faith of that female lay disciple, her adherence to the precepts, her much learning, her kindness and generosity, her wisdom. Having heard this true Dharma and discipline, that female lay disciple may aspire to follow this example thus and thus. Anuruddha, in this way, she will certainly attain some level of distinction and peacefully abide in this. Anuruddha, for this reason, the Tathagata declares of disciples who have died that some are reborn in such and such a place. Some others are reborn in such and such a place. Yeah, first of all, I'd like to note that there is no distinction between males and females based on their sex, in as far as ability of realization is concerned, but there is a distinction between those who are ordained and lay people. And there's some discussion around this, and there are some scholars who have thought they have found evidence for lay arahants in the suttas, and I give you the reference that they use for that. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the problem is that they have misunderstood the expression that is used there, which does not refer only to the attainment of arahantship, but merely to the fact that these lay disciples that I mentioned, they have realized nirvana. In fact, one of the lay disciples mentioned in this passage is Anathapindika. And Anathapindika is on record for having been reborn. And so when he is reborn, he cannot be an arahant. And there are also two householders mentioned in this listing who are elsewhere on record for having been reborn as once returner. I just give you the reference if you want to follow it up. So this passage, which a range of scholars have used to argue for the existence of lay disciples, is clearly not making that point. The position that is taken in early Buddhism is that a lay person is in principle capable even of becoming fully awakened. And the example for that is the householder Yasa in the Vinaya, who, according to the Vinaya account, was a layman, and on his first meeting with the Buddha, he got gradual instructions until he became an arahant. And this is found not only in the Theravada Vinaya, but also in the Mahisasaka Vinaya and in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. However, after he had become awakened, he had reached full awakening, he requested the going forth, he became a monk. We have a variation on this story in the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya, because in the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya we have a different sequence. He becomes a stream enterer, then he asks to become a monk, and only after that he becomes an arahant. But this is not the case for the other Vinayas. So the traditional position also taken in the Theravada tradition is that lay people are capable of reaching up to full awakening, but once they have reached full awakening, they will not remain as lay people. And there's a statement here by Vijayaratna that I would like to quote. He says, "Did they not necessarily become renouncers in the very moment they became arahants? If so, they had no reason to stay at home." This is from Vijayaratna Mohan, Buddhist Monastic Life, according to the text of the Theravada tradition, Cambridge 1990. And I think this just nicely sums it up. And so the tradition usually says that a lay person who becomes an arahant, he or she will try to go forth. And I think this need not refer to full ordination, but would also refer to becoming a samanera, samaneri, or maybe even nowadays one of those nuns' orders we have in the Theravada tradition, like the Dasasimatas, Maichis or Tilashins, as long as they can live a life of renunciation. But if that is not possible, sometimes this is not possible because the person passes away soon after. I don't remember, I think we discussed briefly the story of Bahia from the Udana in this course or the last course. And so he was a non-Buddhist ascetic, and first meeting the Buddha on the road, he became an arahant. And he, right after becoming an arahant, he was run over by a cow and died. So there was no time for him to become a Buddhist monk. And there are some such instances. But sometimes this is misunderstood to mean that somebody who becomes an arahant has to die then very soon. This is not the point. The point is very simply, as Vijayaratna says, a lay person who becomes an arahant will not continue to live as a lay person, but will try to find for himself or herself an environment of renunciation, unless he or she is prevented by passing away from doing so. So the main points from this discourse, I suggest, are this is what we covered last time: importance of joy and delight in the spiritual life, the importance of feeling inspired in one's spiritual practice, let's put it like this, and that restraint and seclusion. You remember the Buddha was pointing out that, according to this discourse, that he continued to practice restraint and lived in seclusion even though he had finished his job. But these are of continued relevance to somebody who is genuinely in vacant. And then the point that we covered in today's lecture, that function of inspiration by hearing about the accomplishment of others. If there's any questions, I would invite you to just feel very welcome to type them in. Let me just clear out the chat so that we can easily see if somebody has a question. But unless you have some question that I might answer right away, I'll just continue with the next discourse. This discourse is a somewhat an allegoric teaching, I think. And I do not want to cover it fully, but I'm just giving you a few extracts from it so that we can get some idea of what's happening here. At that time, there was a certain Brahma dwelling in the Brahma world who had given rise to this wrong view. This realm is permanent. This realm is everlasting. This realm endures forever. This realm is the essence, excuse me. This realm is of an unending nature. This realm is release. There is no other release superior to this release. This is the supreme, the sublime, the ultimate. Then the Blessed One, who with his knowledge of others' minds had come to know the thoughts in the mind of that Brahma, entered a certain concentrated state. Through this concentrated state, just as a strong man might bend and stretch out his arm, he disappeared from Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's Prakatsavati, and appeared in the Brahma world. Before we also go to the Brahma world, let me see the question here by Eric Van Horn about seclusion. If the Buddhist mind was imperturbable, why did he seek out seclusion? I think seclusion is not only the question of avoiding perturbations, but it's simply the appropriate lifestyle of one who is awakened. It's just as that the description is that he would still follow the rules of restraint, even though there will no longer be the unwholesome qualities in the mind that would lead to the type of actions that one has to stop through restraint. This is, I think, it's good that you ask that, Eric, because I think this is really the point that comes up to us from this, the second of the two main points, that restraint and seclusion have a function for somebody who is on the path, but they are of continued relevance to somebody who has completed the path, because they are the appropriate expression of having actually completed the path. Yeah, let me put it like this. And so this idea that the fully awakened one doesn't care about seclusion, no longer cares about rules, and this is a development found in later tradition, but not in early Buddhism. Doesn't mean that the Buddha was in need for seclusion, but when he had the choice, he would rather be by himself. Good question. So, let's move to the Brahma world. The Buddha goes up to the Brahma world, and you might remember last time I suggested, based on this Anuruddha passage, that this flexing the arm and moving could only refer to the mind-made body. At that time, on seeing the Blessed One arrive, that Brahma invited the Blessed One. Excuse me. Welcome, great seer. This realm is permanent. This realm is everlasting. This realm endures forever. This realm is the essence. This realm is of an unending nature. This realm is release. There is no other release superior to this release. This is the supreme, the sublime, the ultimate. Then the Blessed One said, Brahma, you are praising as permanent what is impermanent. You are praising as everlasting what is not everlasting. You are praising as enduring what is not enduring. You are praising as the essence what is not the essence. You are praising as having an unending nature what is of a nature to end. You are praising as release what is not release, claiming that there is no other release superior to this release, that this is the superb, the sublime, the ultimate. Brahma, this is ignorance on your part. Brahma, this is ignorance on your part. At that time, Mara, the evil one, was among that assembly. Then Mara, the evil one, said to the Blessed One, Monk, do not contradict what this Brahma says. Do not oppose what this Brahma says. And he says quite a lot there. I am cutting out parts. Great seer, if a renunciant or Brahmin detests the element earth and disparages earth, water, fire, air, spirits, God, Prajapati. If he desists Brahma and dispatches Brahma, then on the breaking up of the body at death, he will certainly be reborn among the lowliest of nymphs. Great seer, if a renunciant of Brahmin delights in earth, praises earth, water, fire, air, spirits, God, Prajapati. If he delights in Brahma and praises Brahma, then on breaking up of the body at death, he will certainly be reborn among the highest and most venerated Brahmas. So we get this contrast where the Brahma claims his realm is permanent and the best, and the Buddha says this is not the case, and then Mara intervenes and tries to bolster up Brahma's claim and warns the Buddha that if you are against basically creation, earth, water, etc., and all these gods, and against Brahma, then as a karmical result of that, you will be reborn in a very lowly heavenly sphere among nymphs. And if you rejoice in especially in Brahma, you will be reborn among Brahmas. It's a small observation I just like to make from a comparative perspective that in the Pali version, Mara actually takes possession of one of the gods in the Brahma world. And I've discussed that in more detail in my comparative study. For those of you who are interested in these differences, I wonder if something has gone wrong there, because this doesn't really fit with early Buddhist cosmology. It's already surprising that Mara is actually able to travel up to the Brahma realm, because he lives, according to Buddhist cosmology, in a lower realm, but he lives, I mean, this is just one realm below. So this is perhaps still possible, though normally we only get travels downwards, but not travel upward, celestial travels. But for him to actually take possession of a god in the Brahma world seems to be beyond what other discourses imagine to be his sphere of power. And I found this as a recurrent pattern. We even have that in regarding to that famous passage in Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha is on record for saying that he could live longer, and then Ananda doesn't ask him to live longer. And I think in the Pali version, it's again Mara who actually influences Ananda himself, takes possession of him, I believe. So there's a pattern there. You can look up the details in my comparative study, which I just found noteworthy. Vainsho, what about Rohitasa? Rohitasa is just a Devaputta. He is neither Mara nor Brahma. I don't think he's a Brahma. So the Buddha realizes that this is Mara, and Brahma repeats his claims, and then the Buddha points out that he knows more than Brahma. I have again condensed the discourse, because it would take us a lot of time to go through all the smaller points. Then the Brahma said to the Blessed One, "Great seer, how is it that whatever knowledge and vision I possess, you too possess this knowledge and vision? Whatever knowledge and vision I do not possess, you yourself possess that knowledge and vision. Whatever knowledge and vision I and my retinue possess, you too possess that knowledge and vision. And whatever knowledge and vision I and my retinue do not possess, you yourself possess that knowledge and vision." Basically, the Buddha has just told him that he knows more than Brahma and the other gods there up in that realm. "Great seer, you're not saying this out of desire. On being cross-questioned, you will not know how to reply and become ever more confused." And now the two are engaging in a kind of competition, in a sort of disrespectfully, I might call it a hide-and-seek competition. The Brahma said, "Great seer, I now wish to make myself disappear." The Blessed One said, "Brahma, if you wish to make yourself disappear, then do as you wish." Then wherever Brahma tried to make himself disappear, the Blessed One immediately knew, "Brahma, you're over there, you're here, you're in between." Then the Brahma did all he could to manifest his supernormal power. He wished to make himself disappear, but was unable to disappear. He returned, remaining within the Brahma realm. Then the Blessed One said, "Brahma, now I too wish to make myself disappear." The Brahma said to the Blessed One, "Great seer, if you wish to make yourself disappear, do as you wish." Then the Blessed One had this thought, "Let me now manifest supernormal power such that I send forth an extremely bright light, illuminating the entire domain of Brahma while remaining invisible myself. so that Brahma in his retinue will only hear my voice and not see my appearance. Then the Blessed One manifested supernormal power such that he sent forth an extremely bright light, illuminating the entire Brahma world while remaining invisible himself, so that Brahma and his retinue only heard his voice and did not see his appearance. Then Brahma and everyone in Brahma's retinue had this thought. The renunciant Gotama is most wonderful, most remarkable. He has great supernormal power, great and mighty virtue, great merit, great divine might. Why? He has sent forth an extremely bright light, illuminating the entire Brahma world, while remaining invisible himself, so that I and my retinue only hear his voice and do not see his appearance. So basically, we have this competition, this, as I have disrespectfully called it, hide and seek competition. And the basic message we get is, in terms of tranquility and insight, that the cultivation of deep absorption and the corresponding, what according to Buddhist cosmology are the corresponding types of rebirth in the Brahma world, can be so powerful that they seem to be the final goal. But from a Buddhist perspective, this is because of overlooking something. And the Buddha, as the fully awakened one in this hide-and-seek competition, manifests that he is able to see more and to be himself invisible. And then we get another intervention by Brahma, by Mara. And continue to read. Then the Blessed One withdrew his supernormal power and returned to reign within the Brahma world. At that time, King Mara said to the Blessed One, "Great seer, you see well, you know well, you realize well, but do not teach and instruct disciples, and do not teach the Dharma to disciples. Do not become attached to having disciples." Again, I'm cutting out part because he gives quite a lot of things he warns the Buddha of. Then the Blessed One said, "Mara, evil one, it is not because you seek benefit, seek welfare, seek happiness, seek ease for me that you tell me, do not teach and instruct disciples, do not teach the Dharma to disciples, do not become attached to having disciples. Mara, evil one, you have this thought. This renunciant Gotama will teach the Dharma to disciples. Having heard the Dharma, the disciples will get out of my domain. Mara, evil one, it is for this reason that you tell me, do not teach and instruct disciples, and do not teach the Dharma to disciples. Mara, evil one, as to whether I do or do not teach the Dharma to disciples, you just keep out of that. I know for myself when it is proper to teach the Dharma to disciples, when it is not proper to teach the Dharma to disciples." I think this last part nicely relates to the question that was asked by Eric von Horn about seclusion. So we see here there's a purpose also for the Buddha not to be in seclusion. And this is not because he is attached to having disciples or being the teacher, but simply out of the wish to help and to show the path to liberation. But if there's a chance again for him to be secluded, then he would be in seclusion, because that seems to be the condition that is most closely resonates with the condition of the mind after awakening. So the main point, as far as I can see, of this discourse is that liberating insight is superior to absorption and to rebirth in the corresponding heavenly realms. If there's no further comment on this discourse, I would continue with the next one. We are not getting out of heaven. We're still talking about gods. Move on to the next one. Majjhima 79, parallel to Majjhima Nikaya 127. There's a basic setting here that Anuruddha and some of his monk companions are invited to a meal. And so they go there, and at the beginning of the meal or after it, depending on the parallel versions, they ask a question. And a difference between the clearly parallel versions is that the person who invites them and asks the question has a different name, Isidatta and Panchakanga. So these are two different lay disciples, and even though the discourse is closely enough similar for us to consider them clearly parallels, the main lay protagonist of the introductory narration is a different person. Now, Isidatta or Panchakanga, whoever is the one asked about, he wants to basically, first of all, know the difference between what is Mahagata and Appamana, liberation of the mind, Chitta Vimutti. Mahagata means become great or expansive, and Appamana means boundless or immeasurable. So I read the discourse. Venvanuruddha, regarding expansive liberation of mind and immeasurable liberation of mind, do these two liberations differ in both wording and meaning, or do they only differ in wording while having the same meaning? The Venvanuruddha said, Chamberlain, as to this question you have just asked, first answer it yourself, after that I shall answer. So he's trying to see what Isidatta, or in the Pali version, Panchakanga, what his own understanding is before giving a reply. The Chamberlain Isidatta said, Venamanuruddha, regarding expansive Mahagata liberation of the mind and immeasurable Appamana liberation of mind, I think that these two liberations differ only in wording while having the same meaning. And the Madhyama Agama tells us that Chamberlain Isidatta was not able to answer the question properly. This is a remark we don't have in the Pali version, although from the continuity of the discourse it's clear that his reply is not correct. And sometimes we get the reciters making this kind of statements to make sure we get the point. The Venerable Anuruddha said, Chamberlain, listen while I explain to you what is expansive liberation of mind and what is immeasurable liberation of mind. Regarding expansive liberation of mind, suppose that a renunciant or Brahmin staying in a forest area goes to the base of a tree in an empty, quiet place. Dwelling in dependence on this one tree, he achieves, through mental resolve, pervasion of the area beneath the tree with his expansive liberation of mind. His liberation of mind has this limit and does not go beyond it. So, base of a tree, basically, I mean, we have to think that in those days they didn't have meditation centers, but they were mostly traveling, living out in the open. So to sit under a tree is obviously a very useful thing because you're protected from at least drizzling, heavy rain, you will still get some, and you're protected from the sun. And so the area around one tree basically is this minimum area that somebody may be pervading with this Mahagata Chitta Vimutti. And now we get increasingly higher areas that one could, while sitting in meditation, mentally pervade, that to what extent one can expand one's mind. Suppose that dwelling in dependence on not just one tree, but two, three trees, a forest, two or three forests, a village, two or three villages, a country, two or three countries, this whole great earth, as far as the great ocean. He achieves through mental resolve, pervasion of that vast area with his expansive liberation of mind. Yet this liberation of mind has this limit and does not go beyond it. This is what is meant by expansive liberation of mind. So we are talking here about a concentrative attainment that has something to do with an spatial experience. An example would be, for example, the so-called kasinas, the totalities which involve the elements or colors. And so the degree to which one is able to allow this unified experience of the color blue or whatever it may be to expand. It could be just one around the tree where one is sitting in meditation. It could be the entire earth. In each case, this is a Mahagata Chitta Vimutti, become great or expansive liberation of the mind. Now we come to the Appamana, the boundless or immeasurable. Chamberlain, what is immeasurable liberation of the mind? Suppose that a renunciant or Brahmin staying in a forest area goes to the base of a tree in an empty, quiet place. He dwells with the mind imbued with loving kindness, pervading one direction, likewise the second, the third, and the fourth direction, and also the four intermediate directions, above and below, all around, everywhere. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, without fetters or resentment, without ill will or contention, a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. And then the same, he dwells with the mind imbued with compassion, with empathetic joy, with equanimity. This is what is meant by immeasurable liberation of the mind. So we get a similarity in the same sense that there is a kind of spatial pervasion, but by the nature of the object and also by the nature of the Brahma Vihara, which by its very nature is Appamana. And this is what makes the liberation of the mind. You see again this distinction that I was trying to say before between like why we sometimes get the Brahma Vihara side by side with the jhanas. And here again we get this kind of pointer that there is something quite special about the Brahma Viharas. And now he asks, this expansive liberation of mind and this immeasurable liberation of mind, do these two liberations differ in both wording and meaning, or do they differ only in wording while having the same meaning? And the Chamberlain Isidatta said to the Venerable Anuruddha, as I have just now heard it from the Venerable Anuruddha and consequently understood the meaning of it, these two liberations differ in wording and also in meaning. Yeah, then the discourse continues. Yeah, maybe I read this part still. The Venerable Anuruddha said, Chamberlain, there are these three classes of gods, the gods of radiance, the god of pure radiance, and the gods of pervasive pure radiance. Anuruddha is now broaching a somewhat related but different topic. And in the Pali version, there's also a different topic of this type, but it has a fourfold distinction. Devas of limited radiance, boundless radiance, defiled radiance, and pure radiance. These terminologies in the Madhyama Agama and in the Pali version seem to be are not found often elsewhere, and it seems to be quite a specific distinction here in this discourse. And I'm not fully able to understand what it is about. So my suggestion, unless you have some better explanation for this presentation, is that we simply take the basic pattern without of the exposition, without too much concern of whether this is now pure radiance or pervasive pure radiance or boundless radiance, etc. And I am in fact giving you, we will only work through one of these cases. So the Madhyama Agama version begins its exposition of the first of these gods. Of these, the gods of radiance are born in one particular realm. They do not have the thought, this belongs to me, that belongs to me. Instead, wherever these gods of radiance go, they delight in that place. Chamberlain, it is just as a fly on a piece of meat that does not have the thought, this belongs to me, that belongs to me. Instead, wherever that fly goes on the piece of meat, it delights in that place. In the same way, the gods of radiance do not have the thought, this belongs to me, that belongs to me. Instead, wherever these gods of radiance go, they delight in that place. There are times when the gods of radiance assemble in one place. Then, although their bodies are different, their light is the same. Chamberlain, is just as when a person lights numerous lamps and places them in one room. Although those lamps are different, their light is the same. In the same way, when the gods of radiance assemble in one place, then although their bodies are different, their light is the same. There are times when the gods of radiance separate from one another. When they are separated from one another, their bodies are different and their light is also different. Chamberlain, it is just as when a person takes numerous lamps from one room and places them separately in many different rooms. Those lamps are different and their light is also different. Then the Venerable Kachana, the real said, this is one of the monks who has come also for the meal. Venerable Anuruddha, regarding those gods of radiance that are born in one realm, can one know their relative superiority and their degrees of subtlety? The Venerable Anuruddha replied, Venerable Kachana, suppose that a renunciant or Brahmin staying in a forest area goes to the base of a tree in an empty, quiet place. Dwelling in dependence on this one tree, he achieves through mental resolve perception of the area beneath the tree with mentally produced light. His perception with mentally produced light is extremely abundant, yet his liberation of mind has this limit and does not go beyond it. And now we again get this expansion. Suppose that dwelling independence are not just one tree, but two or three trees, a forest, etc., this whole great earth. As far as the great ocean, a renunciant or a Brahmin achieves through mental resolve perception of this vast air with mentally produced light. His perception with mentally produced light is extremely abundant, yet his liberation of mind has this limit and does not go beyond it. This is the cause, this is the reason why, regarding those gods of radiance that are born in one realm, one can know their relative superiority, their degrees of subtlety. Why? It is due to the relative superiority of their minds when they were human beings. In their development, there were degrees of fineness or crudeness. Because of the degrees of fineness or crudeness in their development, human beings have degrees of superiority. So we get the same question and answer exchange for gods of pure radiance and pervasive pure radiance. And before I come to what I believe is the main point, I just like to mention that this is another case where we get a somewhat more rude behavior in the Pali version. In the Pali version, Kachana also asked Anuruddha a question, and Anuruddha replies that he will give an answer even though what Kachana said is offensive. And the actual formulation is not quite clear why it is offensive, but it seems to be that he is kind of wanting to test out if Anuruddha has himself really experienced these devas or has personal knowledge of them, which is of course a tricky issue, as a bhikkhu is not supposed to make statements that point to his attainment, and the same for a bhikkhuni to her attainments in front of lay people. This whole issue about an apparently offensive remark by Kachana is not found in the Madhyama Agama version. So this is just happens to be another of these cases that I mentioned and we discussed briefly in the beginning. So the main point, as far as I can see, is of this discourse is to clarify the difference between a liberation of the mind that is immeasurable and liberation of mind that is expansive. And my personal take, again, this is my interpretation only, is that this again highlights the rather specific role of the Brahmavihara in the early Buddhist soteriological scheme. And the other point with these different gods would be, if we just stay with the basic pattern, is that simply the degree to which one has developed one's concentration in this life will, according to Buddhist thought, lead to a corresponding type of rebirth. So the deeper one's concentration is, the more powerful or lightful or brilliant one will be as a deva if one is reborn in one of those realms. Let me clear out the chat and see if there's any question you have on this. Yeah, as I said, these three types of gods and four types of god, I have not much additional information to give on them. So, in as far as my understanding goes, the main point is only this basic principle that the level of concentration reflects in the level of rebirth. Good, then we continue. This is a discourse, Madhyama Agama 80, which has no parallel at all. And it is one of several discourses in the Madhyama Agama which put a spotlight on one particular disciple. In this case, it will be Anuruddha, which we have already meant in earlier discourses in this chapter of the Madhyama Agama. And I find these all these discourses very interesting. It seems that, you see, after the Buddha passed away, there was the first beginning was to construct a history of the Buddha to give something to narrate to new disciples who had not met the Buddha. And with time, also as the major disciples passed away, there was a need for some more hagiographic slash historical information on the disciples. And in some cases, such as this one, we find this tendency already manifesting in the discourses. So this story is very interesting because the introductory narrative is very interesting because Anuruddha's robes are worn, and he tells Ananda that he needs help to get a new pair of robes. And Ananda calls the monks together to make a new robe for Anuruddha, and the Buddha finds out and says, "Hey, why didn't you ask me to join?" And then they say, "Bhante, would you like to join?" And sure, he comes along. And so we have here the Buddha sitting with the monks together to make a robe for Venerable Anuruddha. I have not heard of this story anywhere else. Then the Blessed One spread out the cloth and cut it to size for the Venerable Anuruddha. And the monks together cut it into pieces, stitched them together and sewed it up. In a single day they completed three robes for the Venerable Anuruddha. I have abbreviated the introductory narration. And after they have completed the robe and given it to Anuruddha, then the Buddha has back pain and says, "I stretch," and Anuruddha, you give a talk. So it's kind of Anuruddha is, and he's asked to give a talk about the one who's getting this robe, so he's going to talk about himself. And what Venerable Anuruddha here gives us now is the traditional account of the gradual path. And this I want to go into some detail because this again is directly relevant to our topic of tranquility and insight. Even though there's a very detailed description of the moralities, all the different type of like not accepting swine and not accepting chicken and not accepting raw corns, I have left out all these parts because these are not so directly relevant to us. At that time, the Venerable Anuruddha addressed the monks, "When I had not yet gone forth to train in the path, I had already become weary of birth, old age, disease and death, sorrow and distress, weeping and lamentation, and aspired to abandon this great mouth of dukkha. Venerable friends, having become weary, I had this contemplation. The household life is confined, a dusty place. Going forth to train in the path is like emerging into a vast open space. Nor for me at home, chained with such chains, it is not possible to completely devote my life to the practice of the holy life. Let me forsake my wealth, little or much, forsake my relatives, few or many, shave off beard and hair, don the yellow robe, and out of faith, leave the home life and become homeless to train in the path. Venerable friends, having gone forth to train in the path, having forsaken the family life, I received the training of monkhood. I practice the precepts, upholding the code of rules. I also carefully maintain proper conduct and etiquette, always fearing the slightest fault, upholding the training in the precepts. Venerable friends, I abstain from killing, from taking what was not given, from sexual activity, from false speech, from divisive speech, from harsh speech, from frivolous speech, from eating afternoon, having abundant eating afternoon. I took a single meal each day, not eating at night, training and eating only at the proper time. I purified my mind with regard to eating afternoon. Venerable friends, having accomplished this noble aggregate of virtue, I further trained in supreme contentment, taking robes just to cover the body, taking food just to sustain the physical body. I took just robes and boats with me, without concern or longing. Just as a wild goose flies through the air with only its two wings, Venerable friends, I was like that. Wherever I went, taking just robes and bowl with me, without concern or longing. Venerable friends, having accomplished this noble aggregate of virtue and this supreme contentment, I further trained in guarding the senses, always mindful of stopping thoughts of desire, with clear understanding, successfully guarding the mind through mindfulness. I constantly aroused right attentiveness. On seeing a form with the eye, I did not grasp its appearance, nor did I savor the form. That is to say, in order to avoid conflict, I guarded the eye faculty, so that no covetousness or sorrow, evil and unwholesome states, would arise in the mind. To that end, I guarded the eye faculty. In the same way, on hearing a sound with the ear, smelling an odor with the nose, tasting a flavor with the tongue, experiencing a touch with the body, coming to know a mental object with the mind. Venerable friends, having accomplished this noble aggregate of virtue, this supreme contentment and this guarding of the senses, I further trained in right attentiveness when going out or coming in, contemplating and distinguishing well when bending or stretching my limbs, when lowering or raising my head. With orderly manners and appearance, I properly carried the outer rope, the other ropes, and the board. When walking, standing, sitting and reclining, when going to sleep or waking up, when speaking or keeping silent, always I had right attentiveness. Venerable friends, having accomplished this noble aggregate of virtue, this supreme contentment, this guarding of the senses, and this right attentiveness when going out or coming in, I further trained in dwelling alone and in seclusion. I stayed in a forest area, or at the base of a tree in an empty, peaceful place, in a mountain cave, on a heap of straw in an open place, in the midst of a forest, or in a cemetery. Venerable friends, staying in a forest, or having gone to the foot of a tree in an empty, peaceful place, I spread out my sitting mat and sat down cross-legged with body erect. With right mental aspiration and undivided mindfulness, I abandoned and removed covetousness, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt. Overcoming delusion, being free from vacillation in regard to wholesome states, I purified my mind with regard to doubt. Remember, friends, when I had abandoned these five hindrances, which are blemishes of the mind that weaken wisdom, separated from desires, separated from evil and unwholesome states, up to I dwelt having attained the fourth absorption. Just a small remark, this is an abbreviation, but the full description of all four absorptions should come here in this place. Venerable friends, having thus attained concentration, with the mind purified and without blemish or affliction, soft and subtle, well steadied, a mind that had attained immovability or imperturbability, I trained in the realization of supernormal powers. Venerable friends, I attained immeasurable supernormal powers, the supernormal knowledge of the divine ear, the supernormal knowledge of others' minds, the supernormal knowledge of recollection of past lives, the supernormal knowledge of birth and death. These are a standard description of the abilities in early discourse that are believed to be possible when somebody has reached the fourth jhana, the fourth absorption. And these involve the supernormal powers, involve feats like flying through the air and diving into the earth. And the supernormal knowledge of the divine ear is the ability to hear sounds at a very far distance where other people normally would not be able to hear them. Supernormal knowledge of others' minds means basically telepathy. Supernormal knowledge of recollection of past lives is to be able to remember one's own past lives, where one has lived, what name one had, etc., what experiences. And the next one, supernormal knowledge of birth and death, is also called the divine eye, is the ability to see the same when other beings pass away. So the idea is that one is able to see that such and such a person now passing away is going to be reborn in such and such condition. And the sixth of these super normal powers then is realization. This is what we are getting into now. I continue reading. Venerable friends, having thus attained concentration with a mind purified without blemish or affliction, soft and subtle, supple, well steadied, a mind that has attained immovability or imperturbability, I trained in and realized the supernormal knowledge of the destruction of the influxes. Remember, friends, I knew dukkha as it really is, knew the rising of dukkha, knew the cessation of dukkha, and knew the path to the cessation of dukkha as it really is. I knew the influxes as they really are, knew the arising of the influxes, knew the cessation of the influxes, and knew the path to the cessation of the influxes as it really is. Knowing thus and seeing thus, my mind was liberated from the influx of sensual desire, from the influx of existence, and from the influx of ignorance. It being liberated, I knew it was liberated. I understood as it really is. Birth is ended. The holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. Yeah, this is the account of the gradual path. Danya Percy is asking, what does it mean having attained immovability? It is the same as imperturbability. This is the Pali term aninja that is usually associated with the fourth absorption and also with the immaterial attainment. Sometimes, as we mentioned in regard to Majjhima Nikaya 106, it refers to only to some of them, not to all of them. And it is also, the same term is also used in relation to the arahant. But here it is the question of immovability or imperturbability is the reference to the imperturbability of the mind on having attained the fourth absorption. The influxes are the asavas, and these are the basic conditions that flow into our experience and that influence our experience in a negative way. And the three are listed here. No, sensual desire, existence, and ignorance. This is the standard listing of the three asavas, influxes, taints, in the early discourses. And a fourth of views is only found in some editions of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and seems to be a later development. And these influxes are seen as basically the main culprits behind samsaric existence. And they manifest in different ways as underlying tendencies, states of minds. But when the issue in question is liberation from samsara, we always get the description in terms of the influxes, these asavas, which are to be eradicated in order to be free from future rebirth. So Anuruddha now draws a conclusion. He says, Venerable friends, if a monk transgresses against the precepts, breaks the precepts, falls short of the precepts, violates the precepts, defies the precepts, blackens the precepts, and if he wishes relying on the precepts, establishing the precepts, using the precepts as his ladder to ascend to the hall of unsurpassable wisdom, to the pavilion of the true Dharma, that is not possible. Venerable friends, it is as if not far from a village there were a viewing tower surmounted by a pavilion. And inside the tower a ladder had been set up, which had 10 or 12 rungs. If a man comes along wanting to ascend to that pavilion, then if he does not mount the first rung of the ladder, desiring instead to directly mount the second rung, that is not possible. If he does not mount the second rung of the ladder, desiring instead to directly mount the third or fourth rung to ascend to the pavilion, then that too is not possible. Venerable friends, relying on the precepts, establishing the precepts, using the precepts as my ladder, I ascended to the hall of unsurpassable wisdom, to the pavilion of the true Dharma, and with little effort I observed the thousand worlds. The last remark is a specific remark related to Anuruddha's ability of exercising the supernormal power of the divine eye, with which he is believed to be able to have vision for even 1,000 worlds. So the Buddha gets up and praises Anuruddha, and I'm not giving you more of the discourse. I think we are coming to our end also, as far as time is concerned. The main point I think that we can take away from this description is the framework that the early discourses established for meditation practice. That's a gradual path of training. And as Anuruddha in this simile with the ladder makes clear, the basis of morality is the first rung to climb. And after morality there comes the cultivation of contentment. Then there comes the guarding of the senses. Then there comes living in seclusion. And only then comes overcoming the hindrances, and only after that the whole issue of jhana development, etc., comes into place. Of course, this is a formulaic description, and whatever we may take, whether we see it as descriptive or prescriptive, I think an interesting point I find is that it shows actual sitting meditation practiced within a context. And this somehow relates to both tranquility and insight, and also to the modern situation in the West, where meditation is often approached with not that much awareness of the context within which it stands. And so, without having done the groundwork, I find it not unsurprising that there are sometimes also problems that people who just sit down to meditate without having done a somewhat gradual build-up, and often with very little familiarity with the teachings that these forms of meditations are meant to verify and actualize, that this can actually lead even to meditation accidents. And I find this just an interesting point to keep in mind. And obviously, I mean, this doesn't mean only monks should meditate and only after they have done all these things, but just to see that whether it's tranquility or insight, the issue is not only tranquility and insight, or rather tranquility and insight developed in a very broad manner, in a way that encompasses various aspects of one's personal conduct and behavior, and that kind of permeates and even saturates at some point one's entire way of doing things. And in such a way, meditation, the actual sitting practice, is well contextualized, and it has a reciprocal conditioning effect with one's everyday behavior. And when one comes to that point also, there's almost no difference. There's just a continuity, whereas we said earlier, whenever possible, emphasis will be given to seclusion, but when seclusion is not possible, there's still a continuity. And I think this, if we can take away this point, it will be very, very beneficial for our own practice, and for also understanding the instructions on tranquility and insight in the early discourses. Yes, and with this, I think we have come to a time to conclude now. Thank you very much for your attention, and yeah, we've really moved on ahead very fast today. There's a lot for you to discuss on the forum with all these discourses, and next time we'll be getting into Kayagata Sati Sutta, talking about contemplation of the body, which I look very much forward to. Thank you for your attention, and looking forward again to seeing you next week. All the best.